Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly recap of local news from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, U.S. Senator Orrin Hatch dismisses court documents implicating President Trump in illegal hush money payments during the 2016 campaign. Hatch also gives a farewell speech on the Senate floor, saying that it's a legislative body in crisis. Meanwhile, an audit shows the state of Utah doesn't have a good grasp on data relating to homelessness and the changing demographics of Salt Lake County, no longer majority Mormon. Joining me for this conversation, Salt Lake Tribune Executive Vice President Tim Fitzpatrick is in studio. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning, Roger.
Reporter Benjamin Wood. Hello, Ben, and welcome to you.
Hello, thank you.
And on the phone from the nation's capital, we've got Thomas Burr, Tribune Washington Bureau Chief. Tommy, thanks to you for being here.
Yeah, good morning.
Good morning. Listeners, you can join us. This is our Friday morning news roundup. You can call us with your questions and comments at 801-355-8255 or by posting them at sltrib.com on this week's Behind the Headlines page. Thomas Burr, you know, I'm struggling to determine which of the stories involving Senator Orrin Hatch that I want to lead with today. I guess I'll begin with the bit of news that he made earlier in the week when he dismissed court documents that implicate President Donald Trump in hush money payments to women who allege they had affairs with Trump before he assumed office. Prosecutors this week said that Trump's personal lawyer, Michael Cohen, orchestrated illegal payments to two women at Trump's direction in violation of campaign finance laws. Hatch was confronted by a CNN reporter for a reaction to this. What did he say?
Yeah, this is very fascinating. Orrin Hatch has only got a few days left in the Senate, and I guess he's speaking his mind. In this situation, mine and Raju, a friend of mine at CNN, caught up with him, and he says, you know, what do you think about these? These are court documents literally saying that at the president's behest, these hush money payments were made. You know, that Michael Cohen pleaded guilty to this and is going to jail for 3 years. And Hatch's response was, I don't think he was involved in any crimes, you know, but you can make anything a crime under these current laws. And then the senator went after Democrats, and I'm just going to read the quote.
Okay.
The Democrats will do anything to hurt this president. And Raju pointed out, well, this is not Democrats. This is the Southern District of New York. This is a U.S. attorney appointed by the president. Hatch said, okay, but I don't care. All I can say is he's doing a good job as president. So essentially, the economy is, you know, doing well. It doesn't really matter.
Okay, and that part that, you know, you can make anything a crime under current laws, is that a critique of campaign finance laws?
I'm sorry, say that one more time.
His comment that you can make anything a crime under current laws, is that sort of a critique of campaign finance laws in particular?
I think it's a critique of Hatch doesn't, you know, he thinks that we've gone way over the top on federal laws, that some of these things should be state laws, and they shouldn't be just, you know, so many laws out there that you can find. If you're looking for something, you can pin a crime on anyone. That's essentially what he's saying.
I mean, the intent of the payments to these women was to keep their stories from getting out and therefore to influence the election. You know, I guess anything can be a crime, but especially when it's very obviously a violation of campaign finance laws. Did Hatch walk back those comments at all ever, or did he stand by them through, you know?
Standing by them, and I guess we'll have to see how this all plays out. I mean, we still don't know what Robert Mueller is going to do, the special counsel, and there's kind of a long-standing DOJ Justice Department opinion that you can't indict a sitting president. So even in these court documents, literally tying the president to a crime doesn't mean that anything's actually going to happen to the president. So, you know, Hatch may be right in one sense that, you know, he wasn't involved in a crime, but maybe he just won't be charged with one.
You know, before we jump into other Hatch news, I'm going to turn to Tim Fitzpatrick for an editorial voice here. And Tim, Senator Hatch tried to play down the news that the president's lawyer says that Trump ordered these payments to quash stories of these affairs. The president, meanwhile, tweeted that it was a quote, simple private transaction. Tim, what are we to make of this? A strange moment in our history, you know, without a doubt.
Orrin Hatch has always been celebrity obsessed. You can go back 40 years, Muhammad Ali, Ted Kennedy, Bono, the list goes on. Donald Trump is first and foremost a celebrity. I think that's why Orrin Hatch has a fascination, if you will. For what it's worth, Hatch has always been less interested in famous women. I think they scare him.
What about, I mean, what does party not play into this too, though, Tim? I mean, it seems a defense of, you know, the president of his party and the standard
bearer. Of course. Of course. You can make the comparison to how he treated President Clinton when he was in a similar, well, not even really, a much lesser situation, frankly. Mm-hmm. And it was completely different. So, yes, he's always been partisan.
I want to remind listeners that you can join this conversation by calling 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK. You know, sure, go ahead, Thomas Burke.
I think we have to point out the kind of love fest between Hatch and Trump has just really continued since Hatch endorsed him in the primaries. In this situation, like, you know, the president just gave Hatch the Medal of Freedom, like the highest medal that a civilian in the United States can get. And Hatch has always been very effusive about the president, saying he'll be one of the best presidents ever. So it's not really a shock that he's going to go to his defense.
Sure. You know, and actually, Tommy, on that note, let's turn to Senator Hatch's legacy, and maybe we'll circle back around to what's been happening in this particular administration. But Senator Hatch on Wednesday, I think it was, gave a speech in the Senate, a speech that is expected to be his last from the Senate floor. He's retiring and will step down with the turn of the year. And in any case, this speech was not exactly a polite taking leave. The senator had some grievances to air on the way out. What did he say in the speech, Tommy?
Yeah, sure. This is kind of a standing tradition in the Senate. When a senator is leaving, they do kind of their last speech, and then other senators come in and say how, you know, how much they love him and how great they are, and those kind of things. But Hatch used it as a kind of a clarion call to say, you know, something needs to change, something needs to give. He says that the Senate as an institution is in crisis, or at least may be in crisis. And he essentially went on about, you know, we need to have some more civility in how we deal with each other. And he noted how, you know, he and Ted Kennedy were able to, you know, work together, how, you know, he was able to get so much legislation passed because he would actually work with the other side. But, I, you know, we have to point out, as Hatch is saying, we need to treat each other with more respect. Hatch has also, you know, use some language that I'm sure I can use on the radio to describe Democrats and liberals and progressives. You know, and we all remember he called, you know, Rocky Anderson and protesters for Bush against Bush nutcakes. It's not like the senator's a saint when it comes to some of those points, but he's trying to say, let's tone down this rhetoric. Let's try to work together if we're going to keep this body as you know, austere as it should be.
Well, and you know, you're pointing to that history, or he points to that history of reaching across the aisle and working with Ted Kennedy and others. But then, yeah, in recent years, maybe not so much the across the aisle lawmaker is what you're talking about there. He did say, though, that he did criticize himself in this speech. He said that that he was guilty of some of this himself, that he had indulged in irresponsible rhetoric from time to time. Is that right?
Absolutely. He said that before, too. He published a piece in Time magazine, I think it was last year, calling for more civility, same kind of speech almost, where he says he, you know, was the first to, he'll be the first to admit that he said things over his career that he regrets. And I think, you know, that's probably true of all of us in some form. The senator, it was actually very interesting that day because other senators gave similar speeches. Claire McCaskill, Missouri, was all about, you know, saying, like, you know, yes, we've really gone too far. And as Hatch pointed out, it trickled down. You know, if the senator is okay saying it, then what's wrong with your five-year-old kid saying it? That we kind of set the bar so low that we're affecting, you know, the nation as a whole.
It's hard not to hear that and not circle back around to the fact that it's 2018 and President Trump is frequently accused of making statements that are less than, I don't, whatever that description was by Claire McCaskill. Tim Fitzpatrick on the Tribune's editorial board. Is there, just looking at Senator Hatch's career, is there an Orrin Hatch pre-Trump versus an Orrin Hatch post-Trump? I mean, it's a 42-year career, and there's a great deal you could address in there. But again, this is the year we're living in, and we, you know, I know people who came of age just this year and voted for the first time this year, and they don't know that long history. Maybe a comment on the politics of today more generally, Tim.
Well, I guess I don't know that Hatch. Tommy said as much. I don't know that Hatch has changed all that much in the last 2 years. I think it's consistent with who he is, and honestly, the message that the Senate is too dysfunctional. That's hard to disagree with. I think there does need to be more civility, and Hatch. It won't be Hatch's problem. It's Mitt Romney's problem now, I guess. And my guess is that we can still function. That, you know, we're not at the end of democracy or anything else, but we are in a rough patch.
Tommy Burr, there in Washington, do you want to comment on the Senate in the Trump era versus the Senate under previous administrations that you have covered? You know, is it different? Is Hatch different? more bipartisan bills in the past than there are today, for example? Is that a
I'd have to say that, you know, definitely the rhetoric is gone up several notches since, you know, the Bush administration. But there's always that tone of, you know, fighting back here, and it's all about, you know, party over, you know, country sometimes, and, you know, making sure your team wins. It's certainly at a higher level, but it's always kind of existed here. What's fascinating to me is the things that Trump says and Republicans accept would be completely unacceptable under Obama. If Obama had said something like that, Republicans would be up in arms. So it's kind of fascinating to see how they just kind of take care of their own team.
You talked about actually, Tim, do you want to weigh in on that for a second?
I was just going to say two-faced.
Wow, okay. A very direct comment from Tim Fitzpatrick. Thomas, you know, you talked about Claire McCaskill getting up, making speeches. Did other senators, you know, rise to sing Hatch's praises? And actually, a question that I have about that is, did any Democrats pay tribute to Hatch's long career on the Senate floor?
You know, there were some. Ron Wyden of Oregon, who's worked with Hatch on the Senate Finance Committee, was praising the senator, somebody who was great to work with, who actually wanted to get things done, and did get, you know, they got tax reform done. As you like it or don't like it, it was pretty impressive to get something like that done in a very divided and divisive Congress right now. But I think there were. There were several people who extolled Hatch for, you know, 42 years. He's the longest serving Republican senator ever, like ever, and he's passed the most legislation of anyone currently alive. So he has had a pretty long career. Again, love him or hate him, you can't deny that.
Well, passing legislation, he's about to pass the torch to Mitt Romney, Senator-elect Tim Fitzpatrick. Any predictions on what the future holds when it comes to the change of guard there?
It was a weird decision of Mitt. He's 71. He's kind of done everything, and he decided to jump in and be one of 100 senators. I think he will do fine. I think that a lot of people are counting on him, frankly, not just in Utah, but elsewhere. It's a good opportunity for him, but it still just seems, it's surprising to me that he decided to do this. I think that it's a step in the right direction in terms of Hatch stayed too long. So I think this is an improvement in that respect, but it's really, you know, what Mitt's going to find is it's a lot bigger than Mitt.
Thomas Burr, just before we head to a break, you're going to be covering Mitt Romney there in Senator Mitt Romney there in Washington, D.C., and he is someone who in the past has made critical comments of President Donald Trump, and that's, is kind of the opposite of what we've been seeing from Senator Hatch, including in these comments to CNN earlier this week. Do you expect to see more of that firebrand sort of challenging of the president from Mitt Romney?
From what my conversations with the senator-elect, it seems pretty clear that he's going to speak out when he feels like he should, but he's not going to be, a Senator Jeff Flake and just constantly, you know, fighting back against the president from within in his same party. But the senator-elect, is not going to be silent. We also know that Mitt Romney is a very polished politician, and he's probably not going to do those kind of comments that Hatch made, that Romney will be more guarded.
Okay. Check out Tommy's reporting on Senator Orrin Hatch's farewell address to the Senate. Again, the longest-serving Republican senator in American history. And yeah, without doubt, the end of an era. You can find that reporting at sltrib.com. We need to take a quick break. You are listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We will be back in just a minute. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW, and I'm joined this hour by Salt Lake Tribune Executive Vice President Tim Fitzpatrick, reporter Benjamin Wood, and Tribune Washington Bureau Chief Thomas Burr. It's our Friday morning news roundup, and you can join us with your questions and comments by calling 801-355-8255. Benjamin Wood, you wrote this week about an audit that the state of Utah conducted that showed that when it comes to homelessness, we really don't know as much as we ought to know, or even as maybe we have been claiming to know. Ben, just tell us about this audit and its findings.
This audit was interesting in its candor. This was coming out of the Legislative Fiscal Analyst's Office, and the auditors, the researchers, essentially determined that they could not determine anything. So in the audit, they talk about how, you know, we set about to try and answer a few questions and very quickly realized that we can't answer anything. There's lots of data, there's lots of information, but it's effectively useless.
Is this about, you know, poor record keeping or poor data gathering or both?
This is kind of an all of the above situation. And in essence, what you have here is up until Operation Rio Grande and some of these recent efforts, the state didn't have as much of a direct involvement in these various programs targeting the homeless population. So you had counties, cities, private organizations kind of all working separately and keeping their own data. And when you try to pool that together, what, you know, what one group uses is different than the other. What, you know, the definitions, the, I mean, it's almost as if they were all using different rulers to measure the same thing. And so you have inches, centimeters, millimeters, feet, you know, just all these different things that have to be converted into a standard data set.
I mean, so I, you know, I look out here on Library Square where the number of homeless people has increased pretty dramatically since Operation Rio Grande. And what I wonder is, do we not even know if there have been improvements in numbers of people or in how many people experiencing homelessness have been helped since, say, the kickoff of Operation Rio Grande?
We really don't.
Wow.
And part of this audit talked about, you know, chronic homelessness and how, you know, over the years, the definition of chronic homelessness has changed so much that they can't even say over, you know, over years what the trend lines have been, what, you know, if people have exited homelessness, if people have been placed in housing, because, you know, people coming in, people coming out of the system has been kept so irregularly that they just kind of threw up their hands and said, it's anyone's guess.
So we could be, I mean, conceivably worse off today than before Operation Rio Grande or than before we implemented this, you know, housing first policy a few years back at the state level. We're just flying blind.
Yeah, conceivably, yes. And the lead auditor, I mean, he did mention that, you know, anecdotally and by all appearances, there does appear to be some momentum. There does appear to have been some progress. He just can't prove that mathematically. There's just no way to quantify that. But there is this kind of assumption or at least a semblance that improvements have been made.
I know we have homeless resource centers coming online in the coming year, but are those centers going to be aware of the numbers of people that they might be dealing with? I mean, this is, you know, you keep data for a reason so that then you can hopefully apply that data to problems and find solutions. But those homeless resource centers might not know exactly what they're up against when they open on day one.
Yeah, and that's true. I mean, obviously, the new resource centers, they're still part of the same network of our current resource centers. So, I mean, the same people are involved. So they have an idea of what they're dealing with. And, you know, I spoke to Spencer Cox, Lieutenant Governor, and he mentioned the opening of these new shelters is the reason for this audit. I mean, the state is looking at kind of a new start on this problem of homelessness. And so to have this audit to kind of come to this determination can hopefully now, as we launch this new era of homeless services, we can start from the bottom floor and do the data keeping right.
Okay, and so that's the fix that that the auditors are suggesting is start keeping your data better.
Right. Yeah. Ideally, like, you know, we're facing this kind of this very obvious chapter. Let's start doing it right so that we don't have audits like this anymore.
I have a comment from Kathy on KCPW's Facebook page who says that, and I get the they here, I think, is probably experts or the state themselves. She says they need to talk to the homeless to deal with us rather than just professionals. meaning, I suppose, you need to have conversations with homeless people and be able to address their needs as opposed to look at it from a top-down level, a comment from Kathy. Tim Fitzpatrick, you're on the editorial board of the Salt Lake Tribune, and I just want to pick your brain here. I can't help but think about how Operation Rio Grande was implemented when I hear about this audit, because what it accomplished was, you know, the attempted cleanup of a very specific neighborhood in Salt Lake City. When it was launched, though, I think we thought it was about more than just one city block and moving the homeless out of it. I guess, does the fact that we're not tracking homelessness outcomes, Tim, does that come as a shock to you?
No. It's really, really hard to. I mean, we're not going to implant chips. We're not. It's the longitudinal data that is very hard. You want to know where a person you helped is 9 months from now, and that is just really, really hard data to get. With regard to Operation Rio Grande, I think that the one thing that it did do is it broke up a drug market. I mean, some of that has now moved elsewhere, but there was kind of an open-air drug market situation there that needed to be dealt with. There are more people who are in jail now. It needed to be broken up. It wasn't a solution by itself. But then the other thing I just want to say is, with regard to homelessness, is that we're not going to moneyball our way out of homelessness. There is no amount of data that is going to take this problem away. We're always going to be in a situation where people are falling down and we're going to have to pick them up. That's what we do as a society. And we don't do it with the idea that we're going to be able to fix everyone and set them going again.
No, I guess the resources you put towards that makes a difference. Far more drastic action is necessary on so many problems that we face, air quality, homelessness. Just on this, Ben Wood, for a second, I want to bring you on this. Outgoing Senate President Wayne Niederhauser, he suggested that maybe cutting back on funding for homeless service providers as a sort of punishment for not properly keeping this data would be a way to kickstart better record keeping. Is that what he said, essentially?
That's what he suggested, yes. And essentially saying, you know, we need a way to incentivize these programs to get their act together. And, you know, what better way than to withhold their funding?
Tim, carrot, well, actually, this is, you know, as opposed to the carrot, this is the stick approach with withhold funding and say, do a better job.
Wayne Niederhauser couldn't do any better than those other people. He couldn't. He doesn't understand the challenge. Hmm.
Any additional comments on this or further reporting from this audit, Ben, and what's going to happen next? I mean, they're basically saying, do a better job. What do homeless service providers say about this?
Well, I think there's – when they presented in response to the audit – sorry, I was a little tongue-tied there.
No problem.
And there is an acknowledgement that, yes, this is a problem, that this is kind of widespread. So I do think the various organizations and entities involved, they recognize the need to iron out some of these wrinkles. And like Tim was saying, the issue is the longitudinal data. I mean, you help someone today, where are they a year from now? And so there is this acknowledgement that if they can tighten up that type of tracking, then we'll have a better idea of what's working, what's not working, and then we can know better what to invest in and what to maybe change.
And the sure. Homeless centers, I think, are focused exactly on that. They're going to track people better in those homeless centers. That's the whole idea. And obviously data can be improved. I'm just saying that data isn't going to save us.
Right. From the state level, this was House Speaker, House Speaker Greg Hughes kind of made this his pet project last year. And now that he won't be there to do that, Who is sort of taking the lead on this, Ben? Do we have somebody from the state level who is in charge?
Yeah, Lieutenant Governor Cox is involved. Speaker Hughes will continue to be involved in some capacity, and his successors in the House and in the Senate will be watching this issue. There's a lot of cooks in this kitchen, and they're not all going away anytime soon.
Okay, a homelessness crisis that also isn't going away anytime soon and won't be easily solved. Ben's story about this is at sltrib.com. Check it out. I want to turn now to another story having to do with data and record keeping, Ben. This one, though, is about the demographic makeup of Salt Lake County. And for a long time, the majority of residents in Salt Lake City have not been members of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Now, though, Salt Lake County has crossed that threshold where there are a minority Mormon population.
That's right. In the county, it was right on that dividing line last year, and this year it slipped below 50%. So the average Salt Lake County resident is not a member of the Latter-day Saint Church.
And this data actually came from the church itself, according to reporting by Matt Canham on this.
That's right. And Matt's been following this annually for quite some time. So the church provides this data to the government so that they can kind of build it into their population estimates. And they are kind enough to give it to us as well. And we kind of crunch the numbers. And so Matt's looking at, so this is the number of people on the church's books compared to the population of the county. So this doesn't get into activity rates. This doesn't get into, you know, who's in the pews on Sunday. Right. This is just raw number of people who are members of the church in the county.
Okay. A quick question I have on that data that the church provides to both the county and to the Tribune is it just numbers, or is it people's names and who they are? And I mean, how much information are they sharing?
Little. It's just numbers. I mean, we get a lump figure for each county in the state, and then we kind of extrapolate from there.
I'm glad that I got that clarified.
Maybe the government gets more, but as far as what we've seen, it's just numbers.
Okay. And it's not just Salt Lake County that has seen a dip in the percentage of people who are members of the church. This is a trend statewide, right?
That's right. It's a trend statewide. And obviously, I mean, Salt Lake County is our largest county, so as it goes, so goes the state by and large. But yeah, I mean, our urban centers, Weber County, Davis County, even Utah County, I mean, there is a bit of a dip if you look at the trend lines over the last few years in the proportion of those counties' residents who are members of the church.
What's driving that?
Well, there's a few things. I mean, you have immigration from outside the state, and those people are less Latter-day Saint than the people born here. Right. You also have people who were formerly members who have left the church, who have formally pulled their names off of the record list, and, you know, any number of other trends that add to this.
Hmm. Former Salt Lake County Mayor, now representative-elect, has he stepped down as Salt Lake County Mayor?
No, not until like the day before he goes to...
Right. So Salt Lake County Mayor, we'll put it that way, Ben McAdams.
That guy.
He put this in a positive light, or talked about this as a kind of opportunity for residents, and especially for members of the faith who are residents of Salt Lake County or anywhere. Can you address what he said, Ben?
Yeah, I mean, he talked about how, in his view, diversity is a good thing. It builds understanding. It builds acceptance. It kind of broadens one's thinking. So he talks about his children and the schools they go to, and how when he went to those same schools, everybody was a member of the church. Now his children, that's not the case anymore. Especially here in the county and otherwise elsewhere in the state, you're seeing people, you know, rubbing shoulders and bumping elbows with members of diverse backgrounds, diverse faiths, diverse ethnicities, and that's just a product of our increasingly more diverse state.
Okay. And Salt Lake Chamber President Derek Miller talked about living in the Harvard-Yale area of Salt Lake City after moving from Provo and having lived in Washington, D.C., and he said that he was sort of taken off guard when he first moved there by lines being drawn so starkly in Salt Lake City, that there was this big non-Mormon divide. But he says that has diminished a certain amount, that feeling of a divide with the increasing diversity here in Salt Lake County.
Yeah, he talked about that, and I imagine it's a situation familiar to a lot of people, especially in the county, where, you know, once upon a time it might have been black and white, you are or you're not, whereas now there's maybe more shades of gray in the middle there, kind of cohabitating peacefully. Hmm.
Tim Fitzpatrick, this is a trend that isn't going to stop as Utah draws more and more people in from outside. Do you want to weigh in on what this means for where we live, you know, politically, socially, and so on?
Honestly, I think the bigger factor is the growing diversity within the Mormon population. Mm. That I think that young people, it's not the whole relationship between the Mormon Republican bloc, I think, is you're going to see it start to fall apart. I think you'll and so you add that to the growing diversity of the state, and I think that we'll be less monolithic.
And by this you mean that as younger Mormons, younger members of the faith come up, they are going to identify less with the Republican Party? Is that what you're saying?
It's already happening, yes. And then, of course, basically, it's just, you know, the fastest growing religious population in any state is no religion. Younger people are you know, they're not going to walk away. The Mormon Church isn't going away. But there is, you know, there is fewer people who want to do that.
Ben, you talked about one of the drivers being, you know, people coming in, moving into Utah for the fact that there's not a majority Mormon population in Salt Lake County anymore. I wonder if this also shows a retreating by members of the faith to other places that aren't Salt Lake County, a sort of flight of Mormons from this county in particular?
Yeah, I mean, that's harder to measure because we just get the raw numbers. You know, anecdotally, I think most people might agree with you that there's probably a gathering in Utah County and Davis County and some of these heavily Republican, heavily Mormon strongholds in the state, you know, maybe away from Salt Lake County. But in our coverage, in Matt Canham's article, he spoke to a former Mormon bishop, a currently practicing member of the church, who did the opposite, who intentionally moved out of Utah County to Salt Lake County because he felt a little stifled by the homogeneity down there.
Yeah, he was in a bubble, essentially. Pam Perlick, a demographer at the University of Utah, talked about members of the church being part of an ethnic group, and that like other ethnic groups, you know, people tend to sort of stick together. That experience of that particular bishop kind of runs counter to what Pam Perlick said in this article.
Yeah, in this case, it was a person who intentionally sought out diversity, and I would imagine that he's not alone in that. I mean, this is an overall trend, but within those trends, you have many individual experiences, some of whom seek out these communities of like-minded individuals, others who seek out these diverse communities, and we'll be tracking the numbers as they shift, but the individual factors there are, as you know, there are as many loves as there are hearts, as Tolstoy wrote.
Excellent quote. There's some great data in this article. Salt Lake County is now the fifth minority LDS county in the state. You've got Carbon County, San Juan County, Summit, and Grand County, all that are not majority LDS. Check out Senior Managing Editor Matt Canham's reporting on this and lots of other interesting data in this article to ponder. It's time for another break, and there's more to come on the show, including claims of gerrymandering and also eventually our underplayed stories of the week. You're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio, and I'm joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Tim Fitzpatrick, Benjamin Wood, and Thomas Burr. This is our Friday morning news roundup, and you can join us with your questions and comments by calling 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK. Ben Wood, sticking with you, and a story about political boundaries in Utah. Earlier this week, you wrote a story that examined data on those boundaries and representation in the state, and this was in response to the overturning of Proposition 2, the medical marijuana initiative. I think I'll just let you explain that. It has to do with the justification used by a number of lawmakers to overturn Proposition 2. Tell us about this, Ben.
That's right. So during the special session, as we were following the debate, probably the most frequent comment I heard was in the Senate, particularly senators standing and saying, well, sure, Prop 2 passed statewide, but in my district, it failed. And they went so far as to say in the majority of Senate districts, Prop 2 had failed despite winning statewide. And if that kind of latches in your brain, you know, welcome to the Wonk Club. I'm there with you. So I started looking at the numbers from our most recent election, looking at the popular vote versus representation in the body next year. And the House kind of has the standout figure in that one out of every three votes for the Utah House was for a Democrat, but only one out of five seats will be held by a Democrat next year. There's a lot of reasons for that, and we explored those reasons in the Tribune this week.
I mean, is the short answer that yes, these maps have been drawn to benefit a particular party, whether or not that was intentional?
See, that's what we can't quite say whether it was intentional or no. What we can say is, for whatever logic went into the maps as they are, the result of those maps is a overrepresentation of Republican legislators in the state. And again, whether that's intentional, whether that's coincidental, whether that's just a product of natural geography, either way, the end result is that there are more Republicans in the legislature than there are Republican votes in the state.
I'll say it was intentional.
Tim, all right, let's bring in Tim Fitzpatrick.
That's the prerogative of
the editorial voice on the show. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, talk about that, Tim. We can look at what the power structure is in the state legislature, but how do you make your case for the fact that, unlike Ben, who's unwilling to go there.
Not unwilling.
I have no opinion on
whether I can go there. And
yeah, yeah, right, exactly. And that data doesn't necessarily show directly a gerrymandered state legislature. How do you make that argument, Tim?
Well, I think Ben just made it. He just couldn't go the last step. But and it isn't unique. I mean, every state has some amount of gerrymandering. But there are some that have improved the situation through independent commissions and that sort of a thing. Well, I guess we might be headed down that road unless the legislature kills it before we get there. You never know.
Well, and this is maybe I'll bring Thomas Burr on this, who's sitting on the line patiently. And Tommy, a quick question for you on this is that independent redistricting has been something that around the country we've seen states want to do, and at the national level as well. I don't know. Do you won't go there as well, but what's your thought on the independent redistricting commission and what it might mean for the makeup of our political body?
Sure. I mean, in states you can see it in some places where it's actually changed, or where courts have gotten involved and said, hey, this is wrong, and we need to have a more fair system. The argument against the independent commission is that they're not elected officials. You can't hold them responsible. So if they do something wrong, the public really has no recourse. But you do see in some places where they do have those independent commissions, a much more level field of Republicans and Democrats coming from these areas, and not just one party dominance.
I remember there was some Associated Press analysis that showed that. You could especially look at the federal level offices in the state of Utah, and maybe there was a sort of argument to be made that gerrymandering had happened there. However, this year we saw the election of a Democrat to a House district. I mean, to the seat, Congressional District 4 seat, replacing Mia Love. We have Ben McAdams, still Salt Lake County Mayor, by the way, for now. Does that sort of contradict the idea that there's gerrymandering?
No. And here's why. And some people will say, well, of course it does. Look, a Democrat keeps winning. One out of every three votes in the state is Democrat. And yet we have four congressional seats, and the best that a Democrat could even feasibly do is to win one of them by a fraction of a percentage point. I mean, that is what you would expect to see. Again, I'm not saying the state is gerrymandered, but that is what you would expect to see out of a state that is gerrymandered. And there's a growing consensus that, yeah, our congressional maps are a little problematic. That fourth district is oddly shaped, which is one of the hallmarks of gerrymandering. But even beyond that, we do see this large numerical advantage for Republicans to hold all four. Yes, the Democrats have a chance of winning one of them, and they do half the time. But from a pure mathematical perspective, one-third of our representation should be Democrat.
All right. And what Ben isn't saying here, but that what Tim Fitzpatrick would say, is that points directly to gerrymandering. Senator Todd Weiler of Woods Cross, Ben, said that he had a sort of retort to the idea that Utah is gerrymandered, or that its voting maps are are drawn in a certain way. What did he say?
Well, he said the winners win and the losers lose. And he's right. I mean, the way our system is set up, you draw these maps, and people run within those maps, and the people vote for whoever they want to vote for. In our state, they tend to vote Republican in most areas of the state. And until we either elect new people or until, something changes in that system, that's the system we have, where, it's person A versus person B. Whoever gets the most votes wins. And yeah, that is how the system is set up. And of course, that creates this tension with the electorate, which was very apparent during the debate over Prop 2, where you had 53% of all people in the state say yes, and then you had legislators saying, well, my people say no. And most legislators could say that.
A parallel story that you wrote about this has to do with a response from House Minority Leader Representative Brian King, who points to a very specific part of Utah and says, here, I'm willing to say absolutely gerrymandering is happening. Where is that?
Summit County. And he said, Summit County is gerrymandered, period, end of story. And he was talking, so Brian King was in the legislature when they vote on these maps. And in fact, he voted in favor of the state maps. And he talked about how overall it was a relatively fair, relatively transparent, relatively bipartisan process. Again, they're drawing 104 state legislative districts. But he acknowledged that, yes, there was still political interest at play, and there were instances of gerrymandering within those 104 seats, one of which that he pointed out was Summit County, which was blown into three pieces, part of which was given to him. The other two were given to heavily Republican districts.
What happens usually when you come around to that time is it becomes about individuals. Their protecting a certain person so that they can still stay in their seat. That's one of the main reasons to try to lift it out from and give it to a commission or give it to somebody else.
Hmm. Will Tim Fitzpatrick? Will you know the Independent Redistricting Commission? I mean, a charge that a number of Republicans make about the Independent Redistricting Commission is that it isn't despite the fact that it's supposed to be nonpartisan, it's going to be flawed in that people are going to have desired outcomes who are on that board. Is it a solution to gerrymandering, I guess, is the question.
A solution is probably too ambitious. Is it an improvement? Probably.
Hmm. Okay.
In terms of the congressional districts are the effect could be essentially that Ben McAdams could be a little bit less of a Republican. You would end up still only with one seat that would be Democratic, but it'd be a little bit safer Democratic. So you would be able to see Ben McAdams, much like Jim Matheson, is going to run every 2 years trying to straddle the middle.
Right. He has to straddle the middle to win that seat. That's just the way that the seat is. And Thomas Burr in Washington, a question for you that I have is, I guess that's just the reality. A question I have is whether or not Mia Love is going to run in two years' time to try and unseat him. Do we know that yet?
No, we don't know. I think she's taking some time. She's obviously upset by her election loss, given the news conference she gave. But yeah, we could see a rematch in a couple years. We could also see her maybe deciding to jump into a TV gig in the meantime. She was on The View the other day, maybe kind of trying it out a little bit. I guess we'll see. But Ben hasn't even taken office yet, so I think we've got some time for that decision later on. Hmm.
You also wrote about Representative Love saying that she doesn't exactly. She's not. This circles back to kind of to Senator Hatch's comments on the president. She said that she doesn't regret calling out the president after she lost her seat. Can you tell us about that, Tommy?
No, she doesn't regret it. In many ways, we all remember the president said, well, she gave me no love, and she lost before we actually knew who had won the race. And she's, fine to poke back a little bit at the president. She doesn't need to suck up to him anymore or say kind things. Let's recall she actually didn't even vote for Trump in the first place. Though she wasn't necessarily always calling him out on things he said, she wasn't his best friend either.
Hmm. I have a related question Ben McAdams, who is going into that seat and who was not a fan of the most likely choice for House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and was voting against her. Is that going to create any problems for him as he enters that caucus?
I think the Speaker's office, the incoming Speaker's office, they know that McAdams is in a tough spot, that he really can't. And I think they cut some slack for some of those districts because they'd rather have the numbers than worry about the percent. And Pelosi already cut a deal with some moderates in the House, so she'll get the votes to take the speakership come January 3rd. Ben wasn't in line to be a committee chair anyway, so I don't think that's going to hurt him. He'll probably land on, House Natural Resources or something like that, which we kind of expect.
Hey, Tim Fitzpatrick, is Ben McAdams sort of the next Jim Matheson? I mean, you talked about straddling that line, but can you point out differences or the parallels there? Jim Matheson sort of famously had to walk that tightrope as well, especially as he moved into the 4th District.
The thing to watch is his money. If you look at Jim Matheson, he ended up getting a lot of money from health care, and he ended up being part of that Blue Dog Democrats that were when they were brokering Obamacare, kept the health insurance industry in it. Watch Ben McAdams, famously got more than half of his money for this race from inside Utah, whereas Mia Love didn't. That will change now. Once you're in the office, you are plugged into the big money. And where that money comes from generally influences how you vote. So watch his money.
Okay. It's a good adage for any political observer is to follow the money, of course, and we will be doing that. You know, I think we're going to turn to our underplayed stories of the week. This is where we look at stories that maybe didn't get enough coverage or that, for one reason or another, captured our attention. And Thomas Byrd, do you want to get us started with an underplayed story?
Sure. I don't know how much people are paying attention in Utah, but the federal government essentially shuts down in 1 week. We don't have a budget yet. The House is gone until, I think, Wednesday. So they really have like maybe 48 hours or so to pass a budget to keep most of the government still operating. So pass through Christmas at least. So that's kind of dangerous. I know we play this game all the time. Every 6 months or so, we seem to be, you know, on the teetering on the edge. But at the moment, there's no budget, and the government shuts down in 1 week.
Sticking point there. Oh, go ahead, Tim.
How about national parks, Tommy? Isn't it, I seem to recall there's some kind of a plan this time, right? They won't close them.
Yes. There is essentially. You know, I think they've tried to make a deal so it doesn't actually hurt, you know, the communities around the national parks and people who have plans to go elsewhere. I need to double check that's still in place. The last time they kept them open.
And Tommy, what's the sticking point for the that's leading to this government potential government shutdown?
It's the border wall.
Okay.
The president pretty much wants $5 billion for his border wall. Democrats don't want to give it to him, and the Senate, they need 60 votes to actually pass a budget. So you need to get Democrats on board, and they're not giving an inch on the wall. Essentially, and the president, as you saw this week, is pretty much like, nope, you're going to give me the money.
All right. We seem to be here over and over again. Benjamin Wood, your pick for underplayed story of the week.
Yeah, our colleague Bethany Rogers has a story from yesterday's speech by Vice President Joe Biden at the University of Utah. He answered a lot of questions, all but the big one we all want an answer to. But nonetheless, kind of interesting story about our once and potentially future member of the executive.
Okay. Check that out at sltrip.com. Tim Fitzpatrick, your pick for underplayed story of the week.
I didn't know I was going to have come up with one.
Oh, that's great. Well, just out of nowhere, what's a story? I don't know. Is there anything that comes to mind? If not, we can. I've got some.
Go ahead.
Think about it, and I'll throw mine out there. Actually, a couple that I'd like to mention. First, Brian Maffley's story on BLM oil and gas lease auctions. The largest auction in quite a few years was held this past week, and there are a number of environmental reasons that people are upset about that, not least among them the climate crisis. So check that out. Also, a story by Tony Semerad that the Daggett County Jail is up for sale. There are people suggesting a variety of uses for it, including a wedding venue or an Airbnb rental. But apparently the county is envisioning a private jail or prison. Daggett County is a very small place, 1,100 people. So if it did become a private prison, the inmates would have to come from somewhere else. And my question then would be, from where? So those are my picks for underplayed stories of the week. Tim, anything coming to mind from this past week's news?
I'm here in Washington if you want me to send some your way.
Oh, we got a little bit of time. Go ahead. Actually, Tim looks like he's ready for something. Tom,
In terms of Daggett County, the inmates that were there, you know, it all went south for them because they didn't know what they were doing, frankly, as they tried to run a jail. But they were always inmates from elsewhere.
Right.
That basically it's a money making thing. So,
but not a private prison.
No, and you know, private prisons. That's they've got a lot of issues there that I'm not really even all necessarily that familiar with. But I guess I'm sympathetic. They've got to figure something else out.
Ben, you had a comment on this?
Well, I'll give you one more local one if we got time.
Sure.
If you're wondering who our next governor is going to be, an opinion person might say that Spencer Cox is running. As a reporter, I'll say it sure looks like he's running. He's put out an invitation to a big, glitzy fundraiser next month hosted by Governor Herbert.
Hmm. That's an interesting one to follow, and I guess we'll keep following it. Tommy, any final underplayed stories?
Nope, I'll yield to you.
Okay, you yield the floor. Well, that's about all I've got as well. We'll keep an eye on Spencer Cox and whoever. But Tim Fitzpatrick, Thomas Burr, Benjamin Wood, all from the Salt Lake Tribune, thank you very much for being here today on Behind the Headlines.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This show is a co-production of KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune, and it is heard across the state on Utah Public Radio. Thanks to everyone who helps make the program possible, including Jesse Ellis here at KCPW, the team at Utah Public Radio in Logan, and the show's producer, Emily Means. Emily, though, is leaving us. She's headed up to Park City to work as a reporter for KPCW Public Radio up there, and we are going to miss her. She's been a force for good here and an exceptional producer to the point that I don't feel even qualified to comment much more than that. But Emily means Godspeed. Have fun. Coming up next, we've got KCPW Presents here on this station. To check out Utah Public Radio's website to find out what's next on their station. You can find podcasts of this and all of our local programs at our website, kcpw.org. And should you be interested, you can always catch up with KCPW on Facebook at kcpw88.3. On Twitter, we are at kcpw. I am at Roger McDonough. Thanks again very much for joining us again on Behind the Headlines. Have a great holiday. Actually, no, not holiday yet. Have a great weekend, and we'll catch you again next Friday. Thanks.